You're listening to the Body Literacy Podcast, your connection to the art and science of feeling really good, body, mind, and spirit. I'm your host and holistic health coach, Jen Mayo. If you've never experienced truth and freedom inside your body, an amazing adventure is about to begin. Healing happens in community. Body literacy is your tribe. Join me in discovering the keys to fearlessly unlocking your body's innate intelligence and resilience. Turn on to the wisdom of your body as we connect your wellness dots by exploring whole person healing, from neuroscience and nutrition to sexual health and sleep. Join the wellness revolution and start speaking your body's language. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce you to the most profound and impactful piece of health technology I've encountered in 3 decades of navigating my own health challenges. LifeWave is a wearable health technology that uses your own light energy to optimize your health. If you've followed the Body Literacy Podcast for any period of time, you likely already know that I'm a bit of a walking science experiment. I have a passion for exploring how time-honored ancient healing arts can be coupled with modern science and technology to optimize our health, wellness, and vitality, and how we can empower ourselves with the knowledge and optimization of our own onboard wisdom and healing potential, rather than viewing the human body as a problem to be solved. LifeWave's phototherapy patches use light to stimulate the body's natural healing systems. By applying LifeWave's non-transdermal patches to specific points on the body similar to acupressure, where the patch covers the skin, infrared light emitted from the body is reflected back into the tissue, stimulating specific regions of the brain and tapping into the body's own flow of energy and the ability to heal itself. LifeWave patches are not intended to treat any specific condition or disease, but rather support the body's own innate healing mechanisms. When we take a holistic approach to health and consider there is really only one state of dis-ease in the body, imbalance, rather than the 32,000 diseases defined by conventional medicine, rebalancing the body and supporting our own built-in capacity to heal becomes a journey of ease rather than a frustrating and disempowering struggle to control dis-ease. Energy medicine operates by a different set of rules than material medicine. I talk about experience-based medicine a lot, and LifeWave is simply a therapy you have to take for a test drive to feel the benefits for yourself. To learn more or try them out, just visit jenmayo.com/LifeWave. On this episode of the Body Literacy Podcast, best-selling author and medical researcher Mark Sloan joins me for a conversation about the challenges of the modern medical system and solutions available to avoid becoming a statistic of status quo protocols that not only do not work, but often create more problems than they aim to address. After losing his mother to cancer treatment at the age of 12, Mark has dedicated his life to being a conduit for patient education and empowerment. Mark brings revolutionary therapies, including red light therapy, balneotherapy, and a not-so-well-known drug called methylene blue, center stage, and reveals how solutions that fall outside of the overpriced pharmaceutical patent system may be the way forward and around a medical system that is too broken to fix. Mark's research focuses on metabolic dysfunction as the true nature of disease as he explores solutions that address upregulating energy metabolism within the cells of the body rather than chasing symptoms with toxic chemicals and often unnecessary surgeries that do not address the root cause of disease. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Jen. It's good to be here. I just shone the red light therapy device, two of them actually on my head, one on the front and one on the side. Usually I go side to side, but I wanted to get the very frontal area this time. So I'm ready to go.
Okay.
It's good to be here.
Does that make you sharper to engage in the conversation, or does that like reduce stress?
Oh, both.
Both. Okay.
Reduced stress means increased energy in the brain in particular. It helps you talk and think more clearly.
Right. Definitely. I probably should have done that before. Well, you have kind of a personal background on how you got into being sort of a health researcher. Can you tell us how you got into writing about alternative therapies and optimizing health and reversing disease?
Yeah. So when I was 12 years old, my mother died of cancer. I guess when I was 11, she was diagnosed, and it turned out to be just a small, size of your baby fingernail, cancerous growth on her cervix. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem that much of an emergency, but the doctors seemed to think it was. So they rushed her in. They said, we got to rush her in for surgery or she's going to die. And so they did that. In a couple of weeks, we rushed her in. And then they said, we want to hit it with radiotherapy as well, just to make sure it doesn't come back. And then there were some cutbacks at the hospital at the time. So there was about 6 months there between that radiotherapy and surgery and her checkup. And when we finally did get her in for the checkup, they said we found the cancer had spread or metastasized to her hip. And now we want to do chemotherapy. And then when they did chemotherapy, it was like she got hit by a truck that day. It was like so obvious, the difference in her health. It wasn't until many years later that I brought that up. And it's like everyone in my family knew that. But it was like we were so traumatized by it that no one wanted to say it. So it felt good, actually, writing the book that I wrote. I guess I should finish this one first before I get into the book. But ultimately, you know, 3 months later after that chemotherapy treatment, my mom died. And it was like a torturous 3 months. It was horrible. I remember laying in bed at night. I could hear her downstairs, like crying and trying to be quiet at the same time so that her kids and family could sleep above.
Right.
So just a real bitter end. And I think a lot of people go through this. And what the question that they don't ask is, you know, is it the cancer that killed them or is it the treatments? So that's one of the things I'd always been interested in. But at the same time, I just got destroyed, age 12, annihilated. So I'm just going through life, like all fragmented and destroyed psychologically, carrying this burden of emotion that I really didn't know what to do with. And it was about 15 years later, like I was working as a limousine driver. So I was driving people to the airport from Kitchener, Ontario, where I'm from, to Toronto, which is like a 1 hour drive. Sometimes it was two though. It's really, really trafficy there. There's so much traffic. It's like the highest volume of cars in of any highway in North America. It's horrible. But at the same time, there was really good things about that job that I enjoyed a lot. And that was the conversation. So that 1 hour to 2 hour distance, it happened to make for some great conversations. And I realized when I opened the conversation with, you know, talking about losing my mom to cancer and just really opening up about it, like not even, I didn't really care after a while. I was like, you know, I might as well just put this out there. It's me, you know?
Right.
And when I did that, it kind of set a platform of vulnerability where people then could also be vulnerable.
Right.
And so it always ended up in amazing conversations. So people would like phone my boss and say, thank you, like Mark's awesome. And they'd request me next time. So I realized it just the human connection that common suffering and trauma we've all kind of been through really is almost like a golden ticket. So I'm like, I need to tell this story in a different way where I can reach more people. And so ultimately I realized, you know, I need to write a book on this. And I also realized, you know, the cancer industry makes $126 billion a year. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be foolish for us to expect them to give us an answer when giving us an answer or a cure means they would put themselves out of business.
Right.
So they're not going to give us answers if we're honest about it. Doctors, they work too much. They're too busy pretending knives and poison pills are medicine all day long. God bless them because their hearts are in the right place. Although, right. Once they get in, they realize there's not much they could do that actually helps people. But so the industry is not going to give us answers. Doctors are not going to give us answers. There's a lot of scientists out there doing a lot of great work that people don't know about.
Right.
They're giving us answers, I realized, but they don't have a platform to make that accessible to the public.
Right.
Because it turns out like the sponsors of the news, basically the popular media, they're the ones profiting from the status quo. And the breakthrough information that will move humanity forward in a positive direction and cure cancer is disruptive to the status quo. So it's the exact opposite of what they want to hear. So as a result, a lot of the amazing breakthrough discoveries about cancer and other things, which is what my work entails, are all out there. And so I realized I'm going to write a book. No one's solving this. I'm going to solve this. Who better than me? I had been researching at that point for like 15 years.
Yeah.
And I knew I was really good at it. And I didn't know what I was going to find, but at that point, I committed to writing a book on cancer.
Yeah.
And it took 3 years and it turned out to be two books and it exceeded my expectations. It turned out that every I has been dotted, every T has been crossed as far as cancer research goes. Mm-hmm. Like no more cancer research needs to be done in order for us to put this disease behind us forever. And so all the information people need to know in order to make that happen is in these two books that I wrote. One's called The Cancer Industry. And the second is called Cancer, the Metabolic Disease Unraveled. And that's kind of where my work got started. And then after that, I realized, well, one of the big realizations in that book about like what cancer is and what disease is, mm-hmm. is that they all have one thing in common. And it's the idea that there's 32,000 plus diseases, which are what we actually have officially classified. Like this isn't true at all. And the amazing and beautiful and simple truth is that there's only one disease, and that's a malfunctioning cell. So if there's one disease, then let's just say the top five most effective and safest therapies will be good for all of them. And this is what it turns out to be. So after those two books, I began writing books on metabolic therapies that would actually heal cancer and other diseases. And so I wrote a book on red light therapy. The next one I wrote was on balneotherapy, which is bathing in mineral-rich carbonated water, which in Western medicine was the primary modality of treatment for the last 2,000 years for everything. A lot of people don't even know that. And that lasted up till the end of World War II. And it was like, it just completely disappeared. So that's a fascinating area of research. And then the latest book I published, which was just a couple months ago, is on methylene blue, another metabolic therapy that works in approximately the same way as red light and balneotherapy. And yeah, these are three of the safest and most effective therapies for cancer and many other diseases. And I'm getting emails all the time now, people saying, or they're basically telling me, you know, this information is helping me. It's helping a lot of people. And I don't know if it gets any better than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll back up a little bit. I originally reached out to you because I was writing an article about red light therapy and I was wanting to get some more information on that. So I just went to Amazon and started searching for books on red light therapy. And yours was one of them that came up and I downloaded the audiobook and started listening to it. But then I realized you had all these other books as well and started reading about your mother's story. And I think there's so much overlap between my own experience and yours. And my own personal story goes back to childhood, but in more recent years, my father took a Viagra and 2 hours later had a spinal stroke that basically changed the course of the rest of his life. And it's not that the Viagra itself specifically killed him, but it's kind of like it was the last straw that literally broke the camel's back. And that just set up, you know, a plethora of different ailments that he came down with that just snowballed one into the other after that experience. And he finally died of pneumonia, basically, in an ICU on a ventilator hooked up to all kinds of horrible tubes and so forth. That's a really profound experience, as you are well aware of. And I have to imagine at the age of 11 or 12, that's even worse. But that really set the stage for me to move my course of life too. I wasn't a limo driver, but I used to be a photographer for many years. And after I came out of that experience, there wasn't really any going back. And I felt like what I witnessed in watching hospital politics while I was in the ICU was so different than anything else that other people were witnessing. I almost felt like I was in the Twilight Zone. And I seemed to be the only person in that setting who was questioning the doctors. So like the attending physician would come in with his team of residents and students with him every morning and go through rounds and so forth. And I would ask very provocative questions of him with regards to the things that they were doing in the ICU really were not conducive to health. And it was almost like the team of students and residents behind him just had this look of awe, like they didn't even know they were allowed to question authority. And I found that to be very eye-opening. And then when they would leave, the nurse and I would have a wonderful conversation about how all the things I was suggesting about holistic modalities of healing and alternative therapies were spot on. But for some reason, Western medicine and, you know, quote unquote, alternative medicine just haven't been able to come together and shake hands because of these political and more bureaucratic reasons. So that's kind of where my story maybe intersects yours as well. But I think you're spot on. I think where you've kind of identified, I guess, that there's more metabolic roots to disease than genetic ones. What are your thoughts on what the Human Genome Project has done to the course of medicine over the past couple of decades?
That's interesting. So you hit on like three points that I actually wrote about very in depth in my latest book on methylene blue, and that is Viagra. Mm-hmm. And also, this wasn't in the book, but I just wrote an article on positive pressure ventilation, the respirators, specifically for COVID-19, but for anything.
Right.
And how those are actually harming people. And they actually, it's been well known that since literally the 1830s, a French physician, Dr. Leroy d'Etoile, he proved that positive pressure ventilation actually causes pneumonia.
Yeah.
And so it's like how many people who die of severe COVID, which is actually pneumonia and symptomatically, how many is that being caused by the ventilators themselves? And of course, when they die, they'll be labeled dead by COVID. So
right.
I thought that was interesting. And then Human Genome Atlas Project. I do have a whole chapter on that as well in my Methylene Blue book, just to basically outline where Western medicine is trying to head,
right,
the direction that they're going in the absence of evidence of it even existing. It's like this delusional fantasy where they can basically create, based on a person's individual genome, therapies just for them to switch on or switch off genes. And, you know, it sounds good, but it doesn't work that way. A disease has nothing to do with genetics. And as far as like the Human Genome Atlas Project, I've done more research into the Cancer Genome Atlas Project. A lot of people don't even know about that one. And that's an interesting one to talk about in particular and hone in on that. So that was launched in the early 2000s. And it was launched by the National Cancer Institute. So this is a publicly funded study. And it's actually one of the ones that are really, really good because they put it all on the line for this. Their goal was to find a specific mutation or sequence of genetic mutations for each type of cancer. So it's like this mutation creates prostate cancer. And then they could create drugs for each individual mutation to fix that. And then it would fix the cancer if that's how it turned out. But when they looked at the sequences inside cancer cells, for example, they looked at individual cancer cells within tumors in different people of the same kinds of cancer. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that the mutations and the signatures of mutations inside those cells were so different, it almost appeared to happen completely at random. Uh-huh. They looked at cancer cells in the same tumor on the same person, and it was completely different as well. And they even looked at like a metastatic cell, which is a cell that's broken away from a tumor and floating through the bloodstream. And they compared that to the genetics in the original tumor. Uh-huh. And there was literally no correlation whatsoever. So what the Cancer Genome Atlas Project actually proved, and there was already a lot of evidence for this that had been mounting for decades, which I talk about in Cancer, the Metabolic Disease Unraveled. But this ultimately was like the cherry on top. It proved once and for all that cancer has nothing to do with genetics. And ultimately, they concluded that no mutation or sequence of mutations have been absolutely responsible for carcinogenesis. And even the co-founder of DNA himself, following the results of the Cancer Genome Atlas Project, even though it's still going, which we shouldn't be funding this anymore, right, but he recommended a switch from in cancer genetics to metabolism.
Interesting. What are your thoughts on funding as being problematic and where the science has gone?
The naked mole rat is an interesting area of research. This is a type of rat. They exist basically on every continent in some form or another, but it's a rat that lives underground its entire life. Kind of looks like Dr. Evil's cat. It's a hairless little rat-like creature.
I've seen a picture on your blog or in the book.
Yeah, and these are fascinating creatures because in their natural habitats, which is subterranean, 100% of their lives, which is very interesting. They are immune to cancer. Mm-hmm. They don't feel pain when being burnt with acid. Their brains can withstand over 30 minutes without oxygen, without any damage. They reproduce from basically like puberty, whatever you call that in a rat, all the way to death. So there's no like menopause, no point where reproduction capacity is halted.
Nice.
And many other like unbelievable features that cannot be explained. So, but they've been studying this. They've been looking at the genetics, of course, and because that's what the NIH and other gatekeepers of funding for scientific research will allow. And that's the thing. There was a recent study that showed naked mole rat cells and tissues literally do not age. And in the study, there's a quote, I'll paraphrase it, but this defies everything we know about biology. And so I've got a friend and fellow health researcher, Georgie, and he reached out to one of the authors and he asked him, you know, why don't you apply for a study to assess the metabolism of these creatures? And the response was like a combination of like anger and fear, I think. I basically said, I just got 3 grants for studying the naked mole rat genome. I don't have time for this metabolic nonsense, which is problematic because that's unscientific for one.
Right.
When you're a scientist, you know, your goal is to find the truth regardless. So they should be curious at those things. But instead, it was like highly dismissive and angry. So basically, that's the situation we're in right now. If somebody applies for a grant, if a scientist applies for a grant to one of these major institutions for funding to conduct a study on metabolism for whatever subject it is, generally, this is going to be refused. And then I think they even get like red flagged so that in the future, they don't get any more funding at all. So,
oh, geez.
That's how scientists are controlled and how the research is controlled. However, not all research is controlled. There's been a lot of good research there, whether it's independent or funded elsewise. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that people don't realize. There's 2 worlds of science out there that are happening. And one is corporate science. So the purpose of it is to create profit. And the other one is to find the truth.
Right.
And the one that is to seek profit, the corporate science, corporately funded. They want people to think that there's no good science out there, because that stuff is what will disrupt their profits. But the reality is there's lots of amazing science. And this is a basis for my work. I started realizing this. I'm like, there's a lot of amazing life-changing info. So all my books contain all that info, the stuff you don't hear about it has an enormous amount of evidence, usually for like 100 years or more, that has just kind of been ignored. I think Mark Twain said it best, a lie can make its way halfway across the world before truth can get its boots on. Mm-hmm. So there's a massive lag between scientific discovery and it being known or adopted by the mainstream world.
Exactly. You had a quote in one of your books. I don't remember if it was from Einstein or somebody who was giving advice to somebody who was deciding whether to go into academia and pursue PhD level kind of stuff, and pointing out that once you're in that realm, you're kind of cut off from independent and critical thought, and you're better off going off being a shoemaker and being able to do your own research as you want. And I think both you and I probably come to this space from a place. Obviously, you didn't originally go to school to be a medical researcher, neither did I, but I did come from a background of storytelling. And I think that's where maybe people like us are pivotal in being a bridge between that scientific community and lay people, if you will, who just don't have access to the information, because I think there's so much jammed into scientific abstracts and journals and so forth. And there is really great information, and there are really great doctors and scientists doing wonderful, innovative work, but it's just not making its way into the mainstream, probably for more political and financial reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely on the same path there. I like to look at my value is in taking complex scientific information and committing to learning it, which is not easy, which is why people don't do it.
Right.
And then translating it into a language that can be understood by anyone.
Exactly.
At any age. If science isn't for us, for the public to better our lives, then who's it for? It's a battle literally between information for profit for corporations and information that will improve our health and lives.
So exactly.
Which one do you want to win? That's why I put myself in between there.
Right.
Between the two tanks. We're both showing the people, the ones, the information, the other side of the story, basically. I'm not going to claim it's true because that wouldn't be scientific. However, when you understand how the body works and you combine that with the info on some of the findings, it really comes together, and we know beyond a shadow of a doubt what's true or not, even though it's important to keep in your mind the possibility on everything you could be wrong.
And on that, can you expand a little bit more on how metabolic dysfunction contributes to disease states of the body, and how might our understanding of these mechanisms really potentially impact our choices for treatments and managing our own conditions?
Yeah, I find that word, people seem to be pretty confused about it, like metabolism. Yeah. What is it?
What is that?
So metabolism is basically a process that occurs within each of your cells in your body, except I think red blood cells don't have mitochondria.
Okay.
That might be the only cell in the body, but metabolism is the process of energy production occurring within cells of the body. And if you think of it like when you wake up in the morning, we've all had good days and bad days. Some days you wake up and you're just brimming with energy. And what happens those days? You get a lot of things done. And on days when you have no energy, you just kind of lay on the couch and mope around and you don't get anything done. Well, the same thing is in our body. Health is a matter of energy at its core. And that's it. If you have adequate energy and your body has all the energy to perform all the vital functions necessary, digestion, reproduction, elimination, all these things, if it has the energy to do that, then you're healthy. So that's what disease is. There's one disease, like I said, that's the breakdown of metabolism. When you have an energy deficiency, your body doesn't have enough to do what it needs to do to maintain health. So metabolism technically is the amount of energy produced at rest. And the higher the metabolism, the healthier someone is. So if you think of like a baby puppy or a baby human, baby anything, they're just, what do? They rip around the room, endless source of energy.
Right.
That is the epitome of health right there. And so it's a good metric. If anyone here is trying to heal, if you've noticed increases in energy, that's a very good thing. My work shows many ways to do that very efficiently. So pharmaceutical drugs, they don't work generally on the metabolism, although there are some, but there is an endless opportunity for them to switch to that and to produce drugs only that function to correct dysfunctional areas in the metabolism. Methylene blue is one of them. Red light therapy is one of them. Sodium bicarbonate and many others.
Okay. All right. Methylene blue specifically, I'd never heard of before I came across your book, although once I dove into it, there were elements of it that I was familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah. So methylene blue, it's a really, really interesting drug. And it was developed in the 1800s, originally not as a drug, but as a fabric dye. So it's a blue dye developed for the textile industry.
Okay.
And after its production, it was discovered that it had many medicinal benefits as well. First, I think it was Dr. Ehrlich discovered that it was very useful as like a stain in microscopy.
Okay.
So, and like a petri dish, you got some cells in there or tissues, and you put in a little drop of methylene blue, and that outlines the cells when you're looking at it, especially under a microscope.
Okay.
So you can see all the tiny organelles inside and things.
Right.
Ehrlich eventually won the Nobel Prize in the 1890s for discovering that methylene blue basically cures malaria in a couple days.
Okay.
So it was for many years an anti-malarial. Well, it still is. But because of the fact that it's blue, it actually makes urine green, like discolors it. Yeah. So that was, and a lot of people don't like that.
Off-putting for some people.
Yeah, yeah. So the chemical companies got to work trying to synthesize another replacement for it. Mm-hmm. And so there have been many replacements for it. Hydroxychloroquine is the mainstream treatment for malaria today.
Okay.
Which is actually a derivative of methylene blue.
Okay.
So that's interesting too. But there is a revival in research of methylene blue for malaria, and they're finding that it still is to this day the most powerful anti-malarial substance ever known. What else can I say about methylene blue? It's also used in emergency rooms when somebody is admitted to the ICU for poisonings or drug overdoses. I actually just published an article on this today. So snake venom, mushroom poisoning, any kind of poisoning, though, this will work for because it manifests in the body in the same way, something called methemoglobinemia, long word.
Right.
Methylene blue is actually FDA approved to treat methemoglobinemia. That's the one and only thing it's approved for, which is intravenously. So you'd have to get that done at the hospital, but this stuff is absorbed just as well orally. Right. So if anyone's like backpacking and afraid of getting bit by a rattlesnake, it's good to have a bottle of methylene blue at your side because it's a very effective and safe antidote. So it's commonly used. World Health Organization listed it as on its top 50 essential list of essential medicines. So they think it's good too, which may or may not mean much to anyone listening.
We won't go there.
Yeah. But the point is, it's very safe. It's effective. It works directly on correcting the metabolism. So it can act as an alternative electron acceptor. So if you think of metabolism, they call it the respiratory chain for a reason. So if you think of like a chain right across the screen, there's one link to the next. And if you think of the links in metabolism as enzymes, it's the enzymes that catalyze the breakdown and further breakdown of glucose into ATP energy. Uh-huh. And if there's one break in the chain, the whole chain fails. So this is the thing. If there's one enzyme missing in the process or defective, then oxygen used by cells is completely turned off. And that really is the beginning stages of all disease and degeneration. So methylene blue and red light therapy are the only two therapies discovered at this point that can remove the environmental pollutant nitric oxide from the final and arguably most important enzyme in the respiratory chain, which is called cytochrome C oxidase. So they remove the nitric oxide off and they upregulate its activity, which means they improve oxygen consumption. More oxygen is consumed, more energy is produced, the metabolism is raised, and the diseases and symptoms of them go away and the person's healed.
Okay. And you had a lot of information in that book in particular about nitric oxide that's kind of counter to what a lot of the mainstream information on nitric oxide is. Can you kind of describe that scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not an easy case to make, but I feel like I've done it very well in the first chapter of my book. So doctors, even naturopaths, nurses, anyone in the medical field, they're all taught that nitric oxide is beneficial vasodilator. And so it is a vasodilator, but I get into that in the book, why it's not beneficial to increase it. I mean, they assume that because it dilates blood vessels, that increasing it's going to be beneficial. But the reality is when you increase it, it actually does the opposite. Turns out nitric oxide is a vasodilator, but in situations of emergency, when the body's primary vasodilator, carbon dioxide, is not available, So they don't understand that. However, I basically, I put out a mountain of evidence in that chapter alone. You mentioned Viagra. Mm-hmm. Viagra works by increasing nitric oxide. And it's also well known to create a lot of problems as well, right. Not only for like the heart, but probably one that is good to mention is like the gangrene of the penis. So after one takes Viagra, basically the erection is maintained for a number of days. Uh-huh. And probably for the first few hours, like it's the man probably loves that. But then all of a sudden, like the pain kicks in, mm-hmm. and it basically blocks blood flow in and out of the penis, and it creates gangrene. And then in many that cases, they actually cut the penis right off. So, oh yeah, it's horrible. So it's a disaster. And
right.
Interestingly, in gangrene, like the blood flow is constricted. So that's exactly what I'm saying. When you increase nitric oxide, it actually, in the short term, it will, the immediate effect, open up blood vessels, increase blood flow, and get emergency oxygen to the site of the hypoxic tissues. But in excess, as we've seen in so many different ways, it will actually create the opposite effect and create a lot of problems as well.
Okay. And I think there's probably something to be said for gentler versions of medicine. I think Western medicine has really, I don't want to go down the patriarchal road, but it's become about forcing the body into submission rather than working with it to create balance. And like, I think we know like nitric oxide is produced when breathing through the nose. So I think there's a balance with so many of these substances where the far end of the spectrum has told us we need to just keep adding more and more and more of it to get the body to submit to something rather than just creating the environment where that natural balance can exist, where the body is producing what it needs when it needs it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Naturally. Yeah.
Seems to be like always a level of toxicity with every drug. There seems to be always like damage with every drug. Meanwhile, the Hippocratic Oath says first do no harm. It's so weird and backwards. Even the screening tests for example, prostate cancer, mammography, probably every other screening test that exists, that even ones I haven't looked into, cause harm in some way. Even right. if it's a needle, it's like we're damaging the person just to right. assess their health. It just doesn't make sense at all. It's insane, which pretty much sums up this world,
right?
Especially right. recently. But yeah,
definitely.
Hey, I just wanted to take a quick break from today's show to tell you about my favorite magnesium supplement, Remag by RNA Reset. Unfortunately, the nutrient density of food is so much lower due to depleted soil that getting enough key nutrients from even organic food is difficult in our modern industrialized times. Magnesium is in my list of top 5 must-take supplements because it's vital to so many functions in the body and can be pivotal in overcoming a wide range of chronic ailments. I often talk about how stress is a root cause of most chronic conditions. The links between magnesium and stress are astounding, and magnesium deficiency is associated with higher stress levels. Magnesium deficiency is linked with fibromyalgia, autogenic stress, physical stress, photosensitive headaches, and chronic fatigue syndrome. Well-absorbed magnesium can also help lower blood pressure, help with chronic inflammation, prevent migraines, and improve insulin resistance, anxiety, and depression. Magnesium is a key nutrient in thyroid function and for the production of thyroid hormones. Remag by RNA Reset uses stabilized picometer magnesium ions that absorb completely at the cellular level. With Remag, the magnesium goes to your cells where it is needed most. RNA Reset is a trusted brand that is passionate about true health. You can find Remag on Jen's Favorite Things link at jenmayo.com. Be sure to use the coupon code JenMayo at checkout for 10% off of your purchase. And now back to today's episode.
And on that note, can you go into a little bit more about the issues with cancer screening? I know you talked a lot about breast cancer and prostate, and particularly in the cancer conspiracy book.
Yeah, so any men and women listening here, listen up. If you've never looked into mammography, which is basically the big cash cow for the cancer industry when it comes to women, and prostate cancer, the PSA test, which is the big one for men, these two screening tests, I'll tell you right now, if I was a woman, I would never get mammography. And as a man, I'll never get the PSA test. And so people who are open-minded will hear that and wonder, you know, why? What do you [S2] Right. [S1] Know that I don't? And I want to share some of that with you, regardless of how well it comes out. The information in my book is so complete, It's absolutely essential. You could easily save your life. How much do you love yourself is what I ask people.
Right.
You know, are you willing to look at this information? It is dark in some ways, but that actually, I think, makes you better, because you can only see the light when you got the darkness there and you're willing to embrace that. You're rewarded with that light and the hope of a better future and things, and the ability to take care of yourself as well.
Right.
So with that in mind, the PSA test is a test for prostate cancer in men, although it was never meant for that. Dr. Richard Ablin, he was the scientist who first discovered, he invented the PSA test, and he first discovered the PSA, prostate-specific antigen, which is a protein secreted by the prostate. And in his book, The Great Prostate Hoax, he talks about and blows the whistle on the fact that PSA is secreted by all prostates, both cancerous and non. Mm-hmm. So using a test that looks at the level of PSA to diagnose cancer just doesn't make sense. So we're right. using a test that doesn't diagnose cancer to diagnose cancer, which is insane. And the result is just, it's horrendous. It means over 1.3 million men. There was a study about Gilbert Welch in the early 2000s. And it was like, since the test, the PSA test was introduced in the early 90s, I think it was 93. It was like over 1.3 million men who didn't have prostate cancer were diagnosed with cancer. So they didn't have anything that would have ever have harmed them. They didn't have cancer at all. And they were told they have cancer. And then, they were rushed in for surgery, chemo, radiotherapy. So the options for prostate cancer treatment, mainstream-wise, are radiotherapy of the prostate or removal of it surgically. And the two most common side effects in that, of those occurring in around 90% of patients, are urinary incontinence. So you pee your pants. You have to wear a diaper, often for the rest of their lives. And impotence. So they can't get erection, can't make love to their wives. Those are like humiliating things that just destroy relationships, rip apart families. And because of this test is useless and it's inaccurate and it overdiagnoses, it's completely unnecessary that these things are happening. And you have a lot of men apparently walking around wearing diapers, which is, I can't even imagine the humiliation of that. So if you ever encounter a grumpy old man, maybe give him a hug instead of dismissing them.
And I've heard even before this that men with prostate cancer generally, if left untreated, die with prostate cancer, not of prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, there was, I think it was 2010, a Swedish study. I just read my book yesterday. This is great. It's coming back to me easier. A 2010 Swedish study basically looked at the 10-year survival rates of untreated men with prostate cancer. So they were diagnosed with cancer. They did nothing at all. Which is, I'm surprised that even exists, because the doctors are so good at scaring people.
Right.
However, what they found was that the amount of people that were still, the amount of men that were still alive at that 10-year mark after being diagnosed with prostate cancer and doing nothing was 97%. So a man has a 97% chance of survival after a diagnosis of prostate cancer. So why would you go through the trouble and risk being urinary incontinent, having to wear diapers, and It's not worth it, obviously. If you have a 97% survival rate doing nothing, then I think most men, if they knew that, would do nothing, which is why you need to read this book if you breathe air.
Right, right. And I think the quality of life factors that don't get factored into treatment options for people or even screening options for people are really overlooked. And I think, let me ask you this, and then we'll go back to the breast cancer stuff too. What are your thoughts on just the word cancer? Because I feel like we're at a point in time where all kinds of C words have so much of a negative charge to them. And I'm really into the mind-body and body-mind connection and how psychosomatic illness is really created by our emotional and psychological states. I feel like at this point in time, cancer almost sounds like a death sentence to everybody when they hear it, when there really are so many cancers that you can live with your entire life and not even know that you have.
Yeah, obviously the word cancer is probably feared more than anything in the world. It's interesting you mentioned like the C words. There's like at least three.
What other ones could we be?
Like, see you next Tuesday in COVID. I like to talk about what cancer is and what it isn't, because there's a myth about what it is that it's not. So yeah, the idea perpetrated, pushed by our culture, governments, corporations, media, is this idea that when someone's diagnosed with cancer, that if they don't kill that cancer, kill those cancer cells, that they're going to die. And this is not even close to true. This is like a mythology. Every culture has their myths. And this one I call the angry cancer cell. There's no evidence of this. There's no evidence that a cancer cell has any intent on trying to kill the patient. This is unscientific. It's also, you know, there's no common sense in that either. It's not how the body works. Why would it attack itself? But almost there's so many different ways, like even autoimmune disease. That's what the mainstream theory as well. And if the body's attacking itself, then the body's a problem. We got to attack the body. It's kind of the way they do things. And it just, it's not, it's obvious it would make things worse. So that's what cancer isn't. And I go through a lot of the scientific evidence showing what it actually is in my book. And so this kind of began when you look at a cancer cell. Actually, I like to go way back to the 1860s. Dr. Rudolf Virchow, he was a German physician, spent his entire career working directly with cancer patients. And what he found was that it was so common among his patients. He found something that was just a commonality. It was so common and universal that he eventually published a paper on it, putting out a hypothesis. What he found was this, that people with tumors, the tumors like began in a place of a chronic unhealing wound. So if somebody gets like an elbow injury and it just, you know, it doesn't quite heal, that is the prime spot where a tumor would form. So bookmark that thought. The idea is injury. And then you fast forward to 1930, Dr. Otto Warburg was looking at individual cells within tumors. And what he found was that a cancer cell is basically a cell with dysfunctional metabolism. We talked a bit about that before. So it's a cell that can't produce energy properly. And when this happens, electrons tend to leak from that respiratory chain we were talking about. Uh-huh. They leak out into the cell. And those are free radicals. And they damage the interior contents of the cell. So once again, a cancerous tumor is damaged. Cancerous cell is damaged. That's the common thread between those two. And since then, it's been established abundantly since then. People have been carrying on that thread of research. And it's very well established now that cancer cells are damaged tissue. So what is a tumor then? Why is there a growth, a mass around it? Well, it turns out when, like, let's say you're skateboarding out front and you fall down and scrape your arm or something, the body's first response to that is to send stem cells to the area of damage.
Okay.
So stem cells hone in on that damage. And when somebody has a tumor, there's something happening there that's different from somebody whose wound heals.
Okay.
And that is that the area surrounding the damage, what they call this the tumor microenvironment, very important area of research, very important buzzword to know. The tumor microenvironment, the area surrounding the tumor wound is so toxic that the incoming stem cells are immediately damaged upon arrival. And then in the process of dying, they recruit more stem cells. So there's this perpetual and vicious circle of a flux of stem cells to the area to heal the wound like a paramedic. And basically you have these dead and dying stem cells. That's what maintains the tumor mass. That's what the bulk of a tumor is made up of, dead and dying stem cells. So one, this is not like some kind of Pac-Man creature on your arm that's trying to eat you. So there's nothing to be afraid of, because it's your own cells and they're dying. And two, now we can understand, you know, a rational approach to healing it. What the body needs is ways to help it heal, or at the very least, not harming it. So that's kind of where my work took me. And understanding that is so important. That's why I really love sharing that with people.
Yeah. And I'll share a personal story too. My grandmother had breast cancer in precisely a spot where she had had an injury 20 or 30 years earlier. So long before I think even evidence like that, we had always kind of associated that rather than kind of relegating it to, you know, some genetic anomaly that we all needed to be afraid of because now we had a family history of it. But definitely it was very precisely at the point of contact where she had had this like dress rack fall on top of her or something. So
very interesting. Yeah. I love hearing that. I've heard many other people say the same thing.
Yeah.
I've also had somebody ask me a question that I haven't had, like a lady who had a tumor that she never had a physical injury. She's like, how else can cells be injured? Because I never had like a physical injury here.
Right.
There are basically two ways. So there's physical trauma and there is the breakdown of effective metabolism within cells, which can happen from nutrient deficiency, because vitamins and minerals, most people don't know, are used to create the enzymes that power the metabolism. So if those nutrients aren't available, that enzyme doesn't get created.
Mm-hmm.
And that will break the chain. Also, toxicity, that can break the chain as well, like nitric oxide, the environmental pollutant, switches off very effectively cytochrome C oxidase. And so that will break the chain as well. And that in turn injures the cells. So two ways of cells getting injured.
Right. There's a really great book called Solving the Autoimmune Puzzle by Dr. Keisha Ewers. And she chronicles in that, there's a lot of other great stuff in the book too, but she chronicles how she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Of course, they wanted to take her down the road of, you know, conventional cancer treatments. And she said, no, I know exactly what this is. She revisited an emotional trauma or situation that she had not resolved within herself, internally went back and dealt with a person who was involved with that, came back a month later and the cancer was completely gone. So I think there's also this component of emotional traumas that dysregulate the nervous system and create endocrine disruption or dysregulation that, you know, airs the body more on the side of stress hormones and so forth that creates that environment for disease. So whether it's physical trauma or chemical trauma or emotional trauma, those traumas all play into that metabolic creation of disease that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. That reminds me of like German New Medicine. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. I don't know a ton about it.
I would say the same, actually. But okay. I kind of know the basis. I like telling people about this one. So Dr. Reich Gerd Hamer, he's a German physician. And the idea with German New Medicine is like they developed like some imaging technologies that pinpoint where in the brain a specific trauma is kind of located or affecting. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, they can very accurately pinpoint how in the body that will manifest and what kind of disease and where. And so it's just fascinating. Thought I'd mention that.
Totally. Can you tell us a little bit more about any like alternative cancer therapies? I know specifically anybody who spends more than 5 minutes with me has to listen to me talk ad nauseum about vitamin C in particular, but you even had some interesting stuff on oranges as use in cancer treatment and so forth beyond vitamin C in one of your books.
Yeah, it's definitely the most thorough scientific review of everything in an orange that can benefit the body from like modified citrus pectin, vitamin C, and particularly the flavonoids. A lot of people don't know much about those, the citrus flavonoids, naringin, naringinin, hesperidin, lots of crazy names, but they do a lot of great things. As far as cancer goes, though, we talked a bit about the tumor microenvironment. I'd like to expand upon that in the context of healing.
Okay.
So what is it in this tumor microenvironment that's causing damage to the stem cells that are there to try and heal that tumor wound? There are many things, but things like free radicals, which is why vitamin C is so useful for cancer treatment, increased nitric oxide, which is why nitric oxide inhibitor like methylene blue is useful. There's increased estrogen, nuclear factor, kappa B, interleukins, all kinds of inflammatory mediators like that, a lot of pro-inflammatory hormones and stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline. And so it's basically like this concoction of inflammatory and stress factors floating around in this tumor microenvironment. And very importantly, a metabolite of the so-called essential fatty acid omega-6 called prostaglandins. If you remove that prostaglandins, for example, from the tumor microenvironment and you neutralize that, then the body generally can heal itself. So that's a very powerful force involved in carcinogenesis. But any of the factors I just mentioned, anything that's like anti-cortisol, anti-adrenaline, and there are some good pharmaceuticals actually that do that as well. They do come with side effects, so some are better than others. Methylene blue is probably the safest and best for that. Amazingly, all the factors I just mentioned, the inflammation and the stress, this is like the best thing you could have hoped for going into this, is that they tend to rise and fall together. So if you just choose one, and you can manage to lower that, for example, methylene blue. It's primarily a nitric oxide inhibitor and an estrogen inhibitor. And it lowers all the rest as well, which is amazing. Okay. Italian oncologist, Dr. Julio Simoncini. I haven't looked him up in a while, so I'm not sure if he's still doing this or if he's even still practicing, but he was around 10 years ago, last time I looked into this, injecting sodium bicarbonate directly into tumors.
Okay.
So one of the things in the bodies of cancer patients that's well known is acidity. Most people don't know where it comes from, but basically when a cell's metabolism and oxygen use is switched off, it ferments that energy substrate, that glucose, and it produces lactic acid. So that's the source of it. It's from cells, from defective metabolism. So what you have in the tumor microenvironment, but also in the body as a whole of a cancer patient, is increased lactic acid. So we've all done that one experiment when we're kids, and maybe when we're adults too, hopefully, called volcanoes, where you take baking soda and you add vinegar to to it, and you get these bubbles and it fizzes and you can add food coloring and it's amazing. I do that with my nephew sometimes.
Yeah.
So the question is, well, what you have there is an acid, the vinegar, and you have the baking soda neutralizing that acid. And in the process of neutralizing it, you get this gas that's formed. And that gas happens to be carbon dioxide.
Okay.
And CO2 is something I talk a lot about. It's another thing like nitric oxide that's very misunderstood. We're taught it's like a waste. Well, medical people are taught it's a waste gas.
Right.
When it couldn't be further from the truth. It's so important. And then environmentalists pretend it's like toxic, even though it makes plants grow like crazy.
Right.
But in the body, it's equally as important as it is for plants. It turns out the body can't use oxygen unless there's adequate CO2. So CO2 is the primary vasodilator in the body, not nitric oxide. That's the backup one. So its effects are twofold. When you add CO2 to the body, it opens up blood vessels to increase blood flow.
Okay.
And it also turns out that CO2 is like the trigger for the release of oxygen from hemoglobin as it flows through the blood. So if there's no CO2, then that oxygen remains stuck to the hemoglobin. The body can't use it.
Okay.
So the CO2 is so essential to have it there. And when you combine vinegar or any acid, like lactic acid, for example, with baking soda, CO2 is generated and that acidity is neutralized. So that's exactly what happens when Julio Sabaccini or anybody injects sodium bicarbonate into a tumor, is that high level of lactic acid, the high level of acidity in the tumor microenvironment is neutralized and replaced with CO2, which it also acts as an antioxidant to the CO2, and it drives oxygen into cells and accelerates the repair process. So suddenly the tumor microenvironment is now cleaned up. And when the incoming stem cells arrive on site, they fix the problem, they repair the wound and regenerate that tissue, and the tumor goes away. So that's one very effective way to do it.
Very interesting. And I think it goes back to just creating the proper balance in the body. I think so much in the Western medical paradigm is this very polarizing ideas of oxygen is good and carbon dioxide is bad, or nitric oxide is good, whatever. Do you think that's part of why we're seeing a resurgence or an awakening, if we will, in breath work in Western cultures now, where some of the breath work practices are really helping us optimize the carbon dioxide and its mechanisms in the body and how it works synergistically with the oxygen?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Are you talking like Buteyko in particular?
Yeah, that or like Wim Hof.
Okay, yeah. Wim Hof is a different story. That's like bathing in ice cold water, but he does breathing techniques as well.
He does a breathing technique. It's similar to holotropic breathwork. I don't know if you're familiar with that, or the more ancient version was called Tummo. He's kind of rebranded it as his own. I think some people have a problem with that, but he's brought it to the masses. So, but yeah, it is a very, the sensations you feel in your body when you're doing it are very interesting. I'll send you stuff after this about that, but.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. He's probably marketed better than anyone in the health field I've ever seen in my life. It's so appealing, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Ice cold glaciers. You put that in an ad and it just looks neat. Anyways, yeah. So Buteyko, Wim Hof, I don't know enough about Wim Hof's breathing techniques, but if it is to slow the breath, then yes, that will increase CO2 in the body. Many modern yoga practitioners, I think, are doing it wrong. They tend to talk like about taking deep breaths, which is actually the exact opposite of the traditional purpose of yoga. The traditional purpose, and I have a number of quotes showing this, of texts from like the 1600s, they talk about how slowing the breath was actually the goal. And so enlightenment was actually defined in a quote in one of these texts as not breathing for like over a minute. So so this not breathing seeks to increase the CO2 in the body. And yeah, that improves the oxygenation. But there was a study, for example, on the opposite end of the spectrum where people hyperventilate and they measured, or they looked at the brain. I'm not sure which type of imaging it was, but it basically showed tissue oxygenation. And with hyperventilating, just for like a few seconds, the entire brain, like the oxygen consumption went way down. So the dangerous levels.
Yeah. Okay. Since I did originally ask you to come on and talk about red light, I think we should probably talk about that. What is red light? And I feel like red light therapy almost seems too simple and too easy, especially now that we can do it at home fairly inexpensively. Can you tell us how that mechanism is working and what is it doing with our metabolism or whatever it's doing there?
Yeah. So red light has been used therapeutically since antiquity. The very first red light therapy device was the sun, and it's free, and we can still get that today. Unfortunately, people who live up in Canada like me or in cold climates don't always have that sun all year round. So things like near-infrared heat lamps or red light therapy devices are good. But basically, when you look at the radiation coming off of the sun, around 60% of it is within the red and near-infrared spectrums, which is 600 nanometer wavelengths to around 1200 in the medicinal range that we're concerned with for therapy. So 60% of the stuff coming off the sun is red light therapy. And okay, a lot of people just don't know that. We all know that, you know, ultraviolet comes off there and that interacts with cholesterol in the skin, which is why cholesterol is so important to produce vitamin D. So vitamin D, when you talk about the health benefits of the sun, that's generally where people, the extent of what they know about it. But arguably even more important is the red and near infrared light.
Okay.
And so you can get that for free going outside, or you can use a device, like I was saying, a lamp or a red light therapy device with precision wavelengths.
Okay.
And it works basically, we were talking about metabolic enzymes. So this is like metabolic therapy, and the cytochrome C oxidase enzyme happens to absorb light within this spectrum. And when it does, it upregulates its activity. So increased enzymatic reactions means increased ATP production. And also along with increased metabolism and ATP production is increased CO2, which is very important because that keeps it going again. So it's very important to have that CO2. Yeah, that's kind of the basics how it works. Red light functions as an antioxidant, so it's very protective. And the beautiful thing is it can reach inches inside the body and it's completely non-invasive.
Okay.
And another thing I like about it is if you take a supplement or something, there always seems to be some kind of like excipient in there that you don't want, like magnesium stearate, for example. But red light is pure. You're just getting pure light. That's just a beautiful thing. And if you think of that like red light therapy versus a surgery, you're not cutting the body to get deep in there. It's a non-invasive way to do it. It's just really, really beautiful. And it's amazingly effective.
Okay. Essentially, we're using light therapy to give the cells more energy.
It administers energy to the body, and then the body converts it very efficiently into the energy that it needs.
Okay. All right.
It's an indirect application of energy. And really, you could say it's the main benefit of it comes from increased CO2. So I think of it in another way as an indirect way to increase CO2. A more direct way to do that would be like drinking a glass of water with a tablespoon of baking soda in there. Once that bicarbonate reaches the acid in your stomach, that will convert it into CO2.
Okay.
That's another way to do it. That's like a direct CO2 injection. Red light can be thought of as an indirect way to increase CO2. It's one way to do it.
Got it. Got it. And what are some of the other benefits of red light therapy? And what's the difference between red light therapy and infrared or near infrared?
Yeah. So the infrared spectrum ranges from like 700 nanometers. That would be the near infrared. There's near, mid, and far.
Okay.
Funny though, when I was researching this, like nobody agrees on the actual numbers. So I think it goes up to like at least 10,000 nanometers for far infrared. So that's that's the kind that you're getting more abundantly in like a far infrared sauna.
Sauna, yeah.
As far as I could tell, it works differently. Far infrared saunas are good. Yeah, I think it's more efficient to go in, like take a bath, for example. Heat is transferred through water, I think like 30 times more efficiently than air.
Okay.
So rather than sitting in a far infrared sauna, you're kind of like, well, you have to like battle gravity. I remember sitting in my dad's one, for example. It's on like a wooden chair. And after a while, I just don't like sitting. So in a bath, you're kind of weightless. So that's a beautiful thing. So I always recommend bathing, which is why I wrote a book on balneotherapy before that. But I guess I'll explain how I think far infrared works. It doesn't seem to be absorbed in the same way by enzymes.
Okay.
But it does heat the body. And the thing with metabolism is it's dependent on enzymatic reactions, and enzymatic reactions, the rate of them is affected a lot by temperature. So you decrease the temperature of the body, even just 1 degree, and the rate of reactions and energy production is going to go down. So any way to improve or increase the body temperature, if it's lower than 98.6, will be of benefit. So I think that's the primary benefit of the far infrared saunas.
Interesting. We could have a whole nother show on body temperature, but we don't have time for that now. But yeah, that's super interesting. Are there any like aesthetic benefits to using red light therapy?
Basically, every cell and tissue is benefited by direct application of red light. Uh-huh. So there have been lots of studies on skin health. There's actually a really interesting one on, it was this two subjects in one, basically. They were looking at the effects of red light to see if it could repair damaged hair follicles and if it could reduce on wrinkles as well.
Okay.
So they basically shone it on wrinkles. They shone it on the follicles and it basically like corrected the metabolic dysfunction happening in there. And then they resumed their function. And so the wrinkles actually went away and the hair began growing again. So those are two amazing things aesthetically that it seems to be able to do. There's lots and lots of evidence for that.
Okay. So again, we're just talking about that supporting the whole body rather than having these targeted treatments. I feel like particularly in the current world we're living in and certain issues going on, there's been this conversation about creating very targeted therapies for individual germs or individual cells that are dysfunctional rather than just looking at the body as a whole and saying, how can we support this so it's healthy in every capacity? And I think that's probably what you're saying, you know, in terms of both the aesthetic qualities that we see with the red light therapy, as well as things that it can do. You had talked a little bit too about the combination of the methylene blue and red light together. How do those work synergistically?
Yeah. So one of the concepts that's kind of all the rage right now in the scientific research, it's called photodynamic therapy, which is one way to do it is to take methylene blue and then sit under a red light therapy device or sit out in the sun. And that combination seems to be one of the most potent treatment combinations for everything. So it's well known that methylene blue has like an antiviral effect, antibacterial effect, antifungal. And when you combine it with red light to make photodynamic therapy, it's even more powerful. So not only for that, but basically everything, because they work in approximately the same way.
Okay.
So you basically put 20 drops of methylene blue in your favorite 8-ounce glass of juice, stir it up, drink it, and then you would sit under a red light device for 30 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
And there's photodynamic therapy. It's been researched for cancer. There's actually a lot of interest in it for cancer recently in the research. Well, that trickled down to the mainstream. It's very inexpensive. It's like $100
right,
versus $150,000 lifetime cost of a cancer patient.
Right.
So we'll not likely see that from the government embracing it or the industry.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we can't get it. In fact, these things are so easily accessible and inexpensive nowadays. For those with an open mind and those willing to think for themselves and question things and look at the evidence, which is what my work enables people to do as easily as possible, those people willing to take responsibility and act like adults, they could do whatever they want. The sky's the limit. You really don't need a doctor these days to heal yourself. That's the ultimate message. Once you understand what disease is, what specifically causes it, and some of the best therapies that can actually correct that root cause of the issue.
Right, right. And I think we need to have sort of a paradigm shift from referring to doctors and healthcare providers as quote unquote medical authorities and shift it more to health professionals or health experts. I think that's a very different dynamic than assigning someone as an authority and then handing your power over to them. So I think the work you're doing is great to that end. And I see a lot more people coming into this space and realizing that our disempowerment is really what's making us sick more than anything. On that note, do you have one piece of advice you would give to listeners for how to empower themselves as patients and be their own advocates for their own health?
Yeah, it's kind of what I was saying there before. Like those willing to look at the things that may not be that pleasant, like the fact of the matter that the cancer industry is basically murdering people for profit every single day in oncology centers worldwide. If you're willing to look at that and make space for that possibility and look at the info and think for yourself, which is what the cancer industry book was for, then you'll be rewarded with enormous ability to handle any issue that comes at you. Once you read the second book, you'll know what disease is, what's happening. And it will completely dissolve the fear of cancer, the most feared word in the English language. If you can take the fear out of that, that's a great step in and of itself towards health, the elimination of any fear in your life. And then you also are rewarded with the ability and the tools to take care of yourself. And there's nothing that's more important than that at this point. Rejecting, not necessarily rejecting what your doctor says, but questioning what your doctor says, bringing in alternative ideas, bringing up my methylene blue book, say, hey, here, read this one, doc. Hopefully they don't slap it out of your head and they're actually open to that. These are the things that can change the world and make our individual health and lives better and society's health and lives better as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Mark, thank you for joining us. Where can our listeners find you online?
My blog and website is endalldisease.com. You sign up for my newsletter there right on the main page. As soon as the page loads, you get three free eBooks. One is It's a scientific review from my cancer industry book on chemotherapy versus cancer. The second one is the entire chapter on sodium bicarbonate in my second book, versus cancer and other things. And then one is a red light therapy dose guide, which shows you the exact doses found in scientific research that you can use that have been found safe and effective for treating specific diseases. So that'll give me some insight there.
Nice. And how many books do you have now?
I just published my fifth book.
And those are all available on Amazon and all the usual resellers.
Yeah, those are on Amazon. Just type in Mark Sloan will probably do it, or Methylene Blue Book.
Okay. All right. And most of those are on audiobook, I think, which is how I listen to most of them. So that's convenient. So you also sell your red light therapy devices, correct?
Yeah, I've got devices, the same ones I use myself. I was like, I'm going to use these. I'm going to make sure I get the best, and I might as well help others find the best too. So we've got a handheld light, a body light mini, and a full body light. So basically small, medium, and large.
Okay.
And some companies out there charge literally like more than double of what we charge. Obviously, their goal is to get rich. Mine isn't. I want to make this technology accessible to as many people as possible. So keep it as inexpensive as possible. And it's all there for anyone who's interested at endalldisease.com/store.
Wonderful. Well, Mark, thank you for joining us today. We had a lot of great information, a lot to absorb, and I hope our listeners will get a lot out of it.
It's been great. Thanks for having me, Jen. I appreciate what you do.
Thank you. You too.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any statements and views expressed by myself or my guests are not medical advice. The opinions of guests are their own, and the Body Literacy Podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. If you have a medical problem, please consult a qualified and competent medical professional. As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Body Literacy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe and sign up for updates over at jenmayo.com.